The Golden State of California appears to be losing its collective mind. You can see the evidence of that loss on the streets of San Francisco. That city by the bay leads us to ask, can we eat our way out of dystopia?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1273rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned in to the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, California was a utopia, but is rapidly becoming a dystopia. The reason for its collapse, some say, is that the state is losing its collective mind. Though there are still a few pockets of level-headedness left in the state, you know, they tend to be way out there, where very few people want to go. For evidence of California's dystopia, take a walk around the city by the bay. San Francisco was one of the world's best walking cities, but has become a live-action Blade Runner movie, wherein the progressive elite live high above the streets in gilded penthouses, while what is left of its middle class wearily walk along the sidewalks past boarded-up storefronts, all the while keeping their eyes fixed on the sidewalk to avoid stepping on needles and piles of San Fran fecal. Why is San Francisco losing its mind? It most certainly is not because the progressive citizens lack compassion. Last year, the city's politicians spent $260 million caring for 18,000 people who could not care for themselves. Not enough. This year, Mayor London Breed championed legislation for sweeping new mental health reform that would double the city's mental health budget to $500 million a year in order to deinstitutionalize, destigmatize, and decriminalize those who can't stay out of trouble. But no matter how compassionate California's progressive citizens may be, and how much money they are willing to spend on the problem of mental health, the state keeps right on losing its collective mind. This observation, which is purely subjective on my part, brings to mind a Food Chain Radio shows I hosted nearly 20 years ago with Professor Stephen Schoenthaler called Crime and Nourishment. Schoenthaler conducted double-blind studies of incarcerated juveniles and adults. One half of each population received a multivitamin supplement, the other halves a sugar pill. Schoenthaler's study showed a 6% net IQ gain, a 6% net IQ gain, and a 38% reduction in criminal behavior within the populations that received the multivitamins. Schoenthaler estimated the cost of providing multivitamin supplements to individuals at a whopping $30 per year. Bottom line, if San Francisco were to treat 18,000 who can't care for themselves with multivitamins instead of bureaucracy, it might have a more mentally fit population and save $450 million a year. Thinking back on those Food Chain episodes of nearly 20 years ago leads me to ask, can we eat our way out of dystopia? Who better to ask than Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, who is the co-author of The Better Brain, Overcome Anxiety, Combat Depression, Reduce ADHD and Stress with Nutrition. What a perfect book for this time. Dr. Kaplan, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you're up in Calgary, and you're a professor emerita at the University of Calgary, correct?
That's right.
And for years, you've been writing on nutrition and behavior.
Right, really how the brain, really the effect of nutrition on how the brain develops and also brain function. So today I think we're going to be talking mostly about brain function. And given what you were describing us about San Francisco, Michael, I am delighted to be talking to you.
Well, how are things going in Calgary? Is it are you still holding yourselves together up there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's nowhere in the world right now that's feeling terribly together, right? So, but what you're raising about homelessness and crime and the neglect of people with problems, that's happening all over because of the epidemic of mental illness.
We are talking about an epidemic. We are losing our collective mind. Bonnie, why are we losing our collective mind?
If you're expecting a simple answer from me, Michael, you're not going to get it. Because obviously there are so many problems. And every once in a while, I actually get criticized by people who say, well, why didn't you talk about the psychosocial problems and loss of family supports and child abuse and all of that? And all of these are very real causes of mental disturbances and PTSD and everything. But my particular area is more neglected than those. And so the reason Julia Rutledge and I wrote The Better Brain is to educate the general public about an area that really has been neglected, and that is the role of micronutrients, meaning mostly minerals and vitamins and essential fatty acids, the role of micronutrients in optimizing our brain health and our mental health.
And there's a lot of work that needs to be done with respect to our mental health. Now, have I lost my mind in thinking we are losing our collective mind?
Oh, no. I don't usually refer to it that way, Michael. That's very clever. But let me just explain to everyone out there that as recently as 1960, the estimated prevalence worldwide of mental illness, we don't usually, you know, the terminology has changed over time. If you go back 100 years, people were using the word insanity. Now we talk about mental challenges, mental disorders, etc. So I don't mean to offend people if some of my wording sounds harsh, but I'm talking about historical knowledge. So back in the 1960s, the estimated prevalence of mental illness diagnosed worldwide was under 1%. If you jump forward to the present time, the World Health Organization says it's 20% at any given point in time. So that's called the point prevalence, but it's 50% lifetime prevalence. That in itself is insane. The idea that one out of every two people will have a serious mental challenge and mental disorder at some point in their life, I find that utterly shocking. The 20% is shocking to me, too. And for those of your listeners who were around in 1960, think back to the people that you knew. And the idea that maybe it would be one in five back then, it's just, you know, mind-boggling at how it has increased. And I just have a little footnote before I let you ask the next question. It's important that your listeners understand that, yes, it's good that people are coming forward more readily and saying they need help. We don't want to discourage that. And that probably has inflated the prevalence rate a bit. And it's also true that that there are other reasons for coming forward and there are more diagnostic categories, et cetera. But, you know, that doesn't account for that kind of explosion.
No. Did you say one in two?
One in two of us for lifetime prevalence. That means one in two of us at some point in our lives will have an anxiety disorder, a mood disorder, etc.
And one in five?
That is the given amount prevalence rate at any point in time. So if you do a survey right now of, say, 10,000 people in our population, you'll find 20% of those 2,000 or more then would currently have a mental disorder. Shocking, isn't it?
Well, it explains why we have indeed lost our collective mind, and that would explain the dystopia. I mean, California used to be utopia. And now it's becoming dystopia. And what you say, what the numbers tell us about what do we call mental problems?
We call them challenges.
Challenges, or
problems, yeah.
Okay. If one in five of us now on the streets is suffering from a mental challenge, and one in two of us will during the course of our lives. So that really makes it for a difficult culture and society to live in. Now, we've been addressing these problems with bureaucracy and compassionate people in those bureaucracies and nonprofit organizations. But it seems like the more we address it with bureaucracy, the more we lose our mind. Now, am I wrong? I mean, it's a pretty devastating thing to say. It's a pretty devastating accusation to make if you think about it. San Francisco is spending $500 million a year on 18,000 people. And yet the problem just keeps getting worse. So to say that the bureaucracy isn't working is a pretty damning observation.
Rather than focusing on your bureaucracy, I'd rather say conventional methods are not working. And I want to say a word about that, if you don't mind. I mean,
sure.
I think that income disparity is a huge contributing factor. And we simply have, I mean, on my entire lifetime, people have been saying we have to do something about this great divide between the rich and the poor. And it's just getting worse and worse. But all the other psychosocial problems and maybe even income disparity somehow don't, to me, account for all of what we're seeing with mental health challenges. And I want to draw attention to something. I'm sure some of your readers will resonate, your listeners will resonate with this. It's tempting to want to say, oh, times are harder now. There are more stressors. There are more problems, etc. But my grandparents lived through World War I, which was no picnic, the Great Depression, World War II, the Holocaust, loss of family in Europe, who they couldn't touch because we didn't keep in touch with, we didn't have the internet. They also had no antibiotics, and then they had the pandemic. So what is different now? I don't really see that psychosocial stressors and maybe even income disparity can account for what's going on now. But I can give you some interesting information about nutrition that I think sheds light on it, which is not getting out to the public.
But it is when we get back from this coming break. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're asking the big question, can we eat our way out of dystopia? And there's a lot of dystopia going around to eat our way out of. Can nutrition help us get out? Doesn't seem like bureaucracy or conventional methods have been doing a very good job. With us today, we have Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, who is a co-author of The Better Brain. And don't we need one of those? Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about working a way out of the dystopia of our mental challenges, I guess they call them these days. How can we get out of them? And we seem to be stuck in them pretty good. So that's the issue today with Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, the author of The Better Brain. Bonnie, when did you start looking at nutrition as it relates to mental challenges? It must have been something that caught your attention someplace along. When did the apple fall on your head?
Well, the apple fell on my head three times before I paid attention to it, Michael. And I don't think we have time to go into all of that here. But I had always been interested in the biological basis of human behavior. And so when I was still in training, I actually was born and raised in the States, and I was in the States working on my PhD. The very first publication that I ever had published in mental health was on malnutrition and mental deficiency. And I even looked at doing postdoctoral research in the area. For various reasons, I deviated from it. I went back and forth and back and forth. And the finally, in the 1990s, I got really fed up. I'll just tell you this much, because I kept meeting true believers, you know, literally people who would say, Bonnie, I believe in nutrition. And I think, you know, on a good day, I might believe in God, but it's not a matter of faith. You know, nutrition just is. It's not a matter of faith. It is understanding what nutrients do in our brain and why we need them in there every minute of every day and night that we're alive. It's basic science. It's basic brain metabolism and brain function.
And with respect to the brain, Bonnie, we understand that the brain is merely 2% of the human body mass, only 2%, but it uses 20% of the blood flow and the energy.
Actually, the estimates usually, it's hard to measure, so the estimate usually is 20 to 40%, which is huge for a tiny little 2-pound organ, 3-pound organ.
So that's where so much of the activity of managing everything goes on.
Exactly.
It's not in the big toes.
No. Our brains are greedy little creatures, and we really need to feed them better. Before the break, I was going to tell you why we should be paying attention to nutrition in addition to all those psychosocial issues. And I want to give you, in our book, we give a bit more history going back a few hundred years. I mean, I've done lectures going back 2,000 years, but I'm only going to give you one example. But it's so important to how we can influence people to improve their mental health. Okay, and I want to keep this upbeat and positive, so I want to tell you this. It was shown 70 years ago that when perfectly healthy, normal young men at the University of Minnesota participated in an experiment, and for 6 months they were given 50% of what they ordinarily would eat for both calories and micronutrients, it was shown that they developed all the signs of depression, anxiety, hypomania, ADHD, etc. And in fact, one may have been psychotic. So 70 years ago, it was proven that taking away 50% of the micronutrients in healthy people for 6 months resulted in really severe mental illness. What are we doing now? Unless you have a very unusual audience for this radio show, then
which in fact we might, when it gets right down to it.
That's right. So you might already know that the ultra processed products, which are in our grocery stores, 80% of the stuff in the grocery stores is ultra processed, has virtually no micronutrients that your brain is starving for. And yet half of what we are putting in our mouths is ultra processed. I mean,
what do you mean by ultra processed?
Ultra processed? Okay, that's a really good question. So, everybody knows what a whole food is. If you pick up an apple, wash it, eat it, that is a whole food. If you buy a jar of applesauce, it is a little bit processed. It might have a little bit of preservative in it, maybe even a little bit of sugar, but it's still a pretty healthy food. Or if you buy frozen peas, the very fact that they were frozen, that's a slight amount of processing. Ultra processed, gosh, how do I say this without naming brand names, Michael?
Go for it.
Just think
Bonnie.
About all the think about all the little sugar bombs everybody eats. The little sweets and treats and packaged donuts and cookies and the sugar cereals and all of those. If you look on the packages, you'll see that they have the macronutrients. That's a very simple concept. Those are the big categories like carbohydrates, fats, protein. I mean, they have to have something in there. It's not really plastic you're eating, but there are a lot of chemicals in there too. But if it is packaged, it's probably mostly those macronutrients. And you know, like the fats are probably not even the good ones. They might be saturated, but you won't find the roughly 30 minerals and vitamins that you need. You won't find the omega-3 fatty acids. You won't find the over 2,000 phytonutrients that are present in fresh broccoli and fresh apples and all your real whole foods.
You know, Bonnie,
that is called ultra-processed.
I often make a similar comparison when talking about the benefits of biologically intense soil. With a biologically intense soil, you feed the soil as many things as you can in building up that very complex web of life in the soil. The soil organisms take those organic compounds and break them down into essential nutrients, and then the plant selects those nutrients as needed. But many farmers or many growers now only supplement with nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, the major nutrients, and not the secondary nutrients, or certainly not the micronutrients. So we become deficient in those things. Before we go on, I'd like to ask, what impact do those ultra-processed foods have on our gut biome, and what impact does that have on our mind, on losing our mind?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's kind of a hot topic in nutrition research right now. People are studying correlational studies, which are usually a real waste of money. And they're just, you know, they give you clues. They don't prove anything. But they're showing that people who are eating a lot of the ultra-processed food have certain things changed in them, everything from changes in chromosomes to changes in bone growth, etc. But it's very unclear as to whether or not the ultra-processed foods are causing those problems, or are they just displacing the micronutrients that you need for your chromosomes and your bones and your brain and everything. So be very wary when you hear about, oh, ultra-processed food is hurting us. It might be that the major way it's hurting us is causing us to cut back on our micronutrient intake by 50%. Does that distinction make sense to you, Michael?
Sure. You eat a donut and you're not hungry for real food.
That's right. And so you don't get the
micronutrients or even the secondary or the major nutrients in real food. So you're displacing your food with ersatz food.
Yes,
food-like substances, right?
Food, right. UPFs. The F in ultra-processed food bothers me because food is whatever is causing our cells to grow and function. And this ultra-processed junk or ultra-processed products, they are not contributing to cellular development or function. But they're called UPFs. Now, you asked about the impact on the microbiome. And this is really important, too. I don't know if we have time to go into it.
Yes,
but
we do.
Briefly, okay, briefly, when you're eating a whole foods diet, you are getting all of that wonderful prebiotic fiber from the things that you're eating from the produce section, which is what feeds the good bugs in your gut. And you want those good bugs to be happy. And while we're on produce, I have to comment on to me, one of the biggest contributions, I think, of our book, but I'm kind of biased, is that we spend quite a lot of time, half of one chapter and then throughout the rest of the book, talking about decreased nutrient density of our food, about the microbiome of the soil, about what food producers are doing and not doing, about what glyphosate and other chemicals are doing to the ability of our plants to give us the nutrients that we need, etc. And I think everybody in our society needs to know about this to support our food producers who are trying to improve the soil and trying to improve the food that we eat.
And therefore, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, Bonnie, cheap food
what?
Isn't.
Right. What are your first and second laws?
Now, let's take this notion then to the city. And here we have a population of significant population of people who can no longer take care of themselves. And so society has taken it upon itself to help them get by, I guess. And we do so with various programs and whatnot, but none of them seem to be working. And I look to what people are eating in the city, especially those who are in trouble. And you know, I see them eating packaged food from convenience stores and drinking, you know, alcohol and drinking lots of who knows what, and taking drugs that have, you know, they're like swallowing a bomb. What impact do those is what is happening to those people's ability to think?
Well, they're severely compromised, and when you can't think right, you continue to make bad choices, don't you? So the first step that any program for people with mental health problems should be focusing on is to educate people about what nutrients do in their brains, and then how to feed their brains better. And any food being provided by the bureaucracy that you were talking about before should be focused on whole foods. This stuff that they sell, I went into a convenience store not that long ago, and I thought, now what could I buy here if I were really hungry? And, you know, nothing. Except maybe a package of stale peanuts, but I'm sorry, I shouldn't say stale. Maybe they were fresh. I didn't buy them. But the point is that people need to be fed, even like our homeless shelters. I volunteer in one here and serve lunches, pre-COVID. Now we're not allowed in, but that's another story, right? But at any rate, I think we did a pretty good job of at least that one meal a day that I was helping with, giving whole healthy foods. But it takes a lot of public commitment to do that.
Yeah, it's much easier to send something in a package.
And yes, much easier.
Bonnie, you did some extensive studies and came up with a lot of good information with respect to nutrition and mental challenges, and you presented this information in your studies. And how was it received when you first laid it on the table and said, "Look at this"?
When I first laid it on the table, there were some families in southern Alberta who had this amazing revolutionary idea that maybe instead of trying to help people with mental problems by giving them, something like a B12 or a B6 or a magnesium or a single magic pill, right?
Well, one element, they're going to hand them some magnesium. Here, take this magnesium and you'll be better.
Right. Some people will feel a little better, but it's so trivial. And they had this amazing idea that maybe, because they knew something about farming and agriculture and farm animals, maybe we should be giving people the entire spectrum of what the brain uses. And so we even have a graph, you know, some information about that in the book to explain why there are roughly 30 vitamins and minerals. Plants need about 15 minerals from the soil to really synthesize properly the vitamins that we need. And then we hopefully eat about 30 minerals and vitamins as a result of healthy plants. So they decided to do a broad spectrum approach. And I saw some amazing transformations in people and thought, I've got to do research. So I collected the data on my first group of people and presented it to a meeting of psychiatrists. And everybody wanted to know which nutrient, Michael, was the important one. Can you believe that? Which one?
And when you told them, I don't know.
I said, they all are. It's the wrong question. But that was a real hard sell. And it evoked huge hostility. And people are often very negative about the things that they haven't learned in school. So one of the things we talk about a lot in the book is that people should be learning about nutrition of this type when they are in school.
Well, we're going to take a break here in a minute or so, but I wanted to point out with respect to who knows a lot about nutrition, it generally isn't doctors. And I point to Dr. Andrew Weil, who wrote a foreword for The Better Brain. And in his comments, he said, in 4 years of Harvard Medical School, I had exactly 30 minutes of time talking about nutrition. So it kind of goes to show that nutrition is not part of medicine. How did that come to be? That's where we'll go when we get back from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, the co-author of The Better Brain. And don't we all need one? Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutrientsToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutrientsToGo.com. NutrientsToGo.com.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we do have a lot to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. We're talking about nutrition and how we lost our way. How did we lose our way with respect to nutrition, Bonnie?
Well, I want to say that things are changing a lot for physical health. I think a lot of family doctors are really understanding that they need to help their patients with lifestyle variables. What's still not as well known is the importance of the brain. And Michael, you were talking about how the brain really is, when we're eating, we're mostly feeding this metabolically demanding organ that the top of our body. So it's, in fact, sometimes I call my lectures nutrition above the neck, because if I just called them nutrition for health, people would be thinking about obesity, diabetes, et cetera, because those are so prominent. But what we need people to understand is not just that nutrition matters for brain health, but they need to understand why. So like in our book, we explain, and everyone's telling us it's understandable to everybody in the general public, so it's not real science-y, but we explain how it is that metabolism works. And why a single nutrient is not any of them, not vitamin D, not omega-3s, no single nutrient is going to fix or optimize your brain function.
And you know what, it gets right down to it, Bonnie, with respect to a plant growing in the soil, nobody knows exactly what that plant needs. And so when it comes right down to it, how do you feed that plant? The best way to feed that plant is to feed the soil and let, you know, have a well-balanced, biologically rich soil. And then everything is there. And then the plant can take what it needs when it needs it. And that's pretty much exactly what you're talking about with respect to multivitamins and minerals, correct?
Yeah, so what you're saying is that our blood supply that's perfusing our brain with oxygen and nutrients and so forth, that it's kind of like the soil the plants grow in. And we want our blood supply to be very, very rich in all the nutrients so that they're available for the brain to pull from. Huh, I never thought of it that way, Michael.
Well, that's what you get for talking with an ag kind of guy.
That's right.
But it's all about nutrition. It's nutrition of the soil and the nutrition of our bodies. I got to thinking as you were describing how you position your lectures as nutrition for above the neck. And I got to thinking that, well, we never think of our brain and our mind because the mind and the brain are always thinking about other things. Well, how's my big toe doing today? The mind maybe doesn't think so much about itself. And how would that translate to people who are in trouble mentally? Do they think they're in trouble?
No, they don't. If they think they're in trouble, they usually attribute it to factors outside of them, which are probably very relevant. It's not that they're delusional. There are a lot of things going against people who are struggling in life. But, you know, even for them, nutrition, and this is, might be the most important thing I say in this whole hour, Michael, so you can quote me, nutrition is the foundation of our resilience. It's the foundation of the resilience of every living organism. And so even though you can't always change what's around you, the environmental things, you can cope better. And so we have a whole chapter on stress and resilience in the book, which we think is very, very relevant to the pandemic and the times that we're living through, because it's been shown time and again through quite a few placebo-controlled randomized trials that enhancing nutrient intake enables us to cope better with life.
Yeah. And you know what you say is kind of like Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, which is agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Because if we don't have a sufficient supply of food, good food, we're not going to be building any sandcastles. And it seems to me like that's kind of where we're headed.
I couldn't agree more. It all begins in the soil. And one of the most exciting experiences I've had in the last maybe 5 years is speaking to quite a few different groups of people who are agricultural experts. And then there's this one talk on human brain health, and they're blown away when people, they're people too, you know, and they realize how important what they do with their, in their fields, how important that is for society's brain health.
And so we're kind of tracking right along here together. And does the eating habits of populations correlate to their mental health? So we see the population of, there's 18,000 people on the streets of San Francisco. Do you think that you could look at what they're eating and correlate that to their mental health?
Well, I think you definitely could correlate it. But as I said before, correlational studies don't contribute a lot in terms of understanding causation. So what we also have in the scientific literature is very clear data from a couple different countries, Canada and Australia for sure, showing that if you take a group of people, and this goes down to the age of 11, I mean, what are we doing to our children? We say it's okay to live on pizza and processed stuff. And anyway, so what these studies show is if you take a group of people, evaluate how they're eating, they have no mental health problems, and you come back a few years later and find out who has been referred to a physician for a diagnosis and treatment of a mental health disorder. And what you find is that how they were eating the few years previously predicts their risk for a mental health problem. That is the most powerful data. I mean, there's research also from the Sun study in Spain that shows that very, very clearly. And what the Sun study shows, by the way, is you don't have to be a purist. Like I always say, life might not be worth living if I couldn't eat a chocolate chip cookie sometimes. But it's okay to eat processed food in very small moderation. But the most of your food intake has to feed your brain if you want to avoid depression, anxiety, et cetera, 6-7 years later.
Wow. It calls to mind.
We can't go back.
It calls to mind.
You're 18.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you go. No, you go ahead.
Oh, it calls to mind something I heard somebody say once, 20 seconds on the lips, forever on the hips. So so you eat it, it's enjoyable for a moment, but boy, you're going to pay for it forever. So it's kind of what we're looking at here. Well, Bonnie,
that's right.
What happens? It would seem like what you're saying is a great threat to those who make pharmaceutical cures for mental challenges.
Well, there's a place for psychiatric medications. In the final chapter of our book, we talk about our vision for a better future. And medication is in step three. But it's not step one. But you see, in our conventional treatment right now, people go to a doctor, they get a diagnosis, and they get a drug. And that's the wrong approach. We should be teaching them about nutrition. We know from we cover a lot of studies in our book where we show very clearly that you can reduce the psychiatric symptoms with better nutrition. So nutrition first, and then also everything involving social support, exercise, lifestyle stuff. And then as a third step, some people will still benefit from small amounts of psychiatric medication. But, you know, a lot of people find that as they nourish their brain better, they can get along on less medication, that they can reduce their psychiatric medication load. And that's a good news story for them. Maybe not for the drug companies, but it's a good news story. They feel better.
Mm-hmm. Are you a threat to the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, they apparently think so, because there's a good reason to believe that a lot of the problems that I have gone through have been indirectly sponsored by them. Let's just leave it at that. But who cares? I mean, the world is changing. We really need healthier brains. We need to avoid, you know, there's very good research on, there's no drug treatment for dementia, but there's very good treatment of cutting the risk of dementia with better nutrition. Why doesn't the public know more about that? We have to start caring for our brains, and I feel very strongly about it, and I don't care who's offended.
Well, good. I'm happy you feel that way, because I am going to put you in charge of mental health for the city of San Francisco. And I'm going to give you I'm going to give you the $500 million a year budget that they're spending on mental health for the city of San Francisco. Where does Bonnie start first?
Oh, where I start first is feeding their brains. Absolutely. And because that's not going to cost $500 million, we'll also work on affordable housing, which I know is a huge problem in your city, too. It is everywhere. But first and foremost, we're going to feed their brains. And when they can think more clearly, we're going to educate them as to why. And we're going to teach them then how to cook, etc. And for some people, because of the decreased nutrient density in our food, and because also of individual differences, for some people, we're going to give them nutrients in pill form, too.
Okay.
But not one at a time. We're going to give them broad spectrum micronutrients,
like the ones
that have been proven to help.
Yeah. And some of them are not going to want to do that. You're going to have to. Some people who are suffering from mental challenges are not going to want to eat whole foods. And they're going to want to keep doing the drugs. So you're going to have to either lock them up and force feed them good foods for a while. How would you consider that? Or what are you going to do with the ones that refuse?
Well, first of all, a lot of the times when people refuse, and I've seen this working in the homeless shelter, it's because of their huge dental problems, and they can't chew some of the more fibrous, I mean, even a raw carrot, it's just too painful. So we're going to get them dental care too. That is a huge issue for them. But as you're improving their nutrition, their dental problems will also decrease. So we're going to work with them, and we're going to focus on the ones who want to cooperate. And that's going to be the vast majority of them, because we're going to feed them so well, Michael, that they're going to love the food. And we're going to be giving them some nutrients on the side, broad spectrum micronutrients. So that's going to make them feel more energetic and better about themselves. Okay? Well, are we ready?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely ready, because looking back 20 years ago to the shows I did with Dr. Daniel Schoenthaler called Stephen Schoenthaler called Crime and Nourishment. And it was a very simple, very, very simple application of multivitamins, a cheap one, the cheapest off the shelf multivitamin you could find. And he gave half the prison population and the reform school population a multivitamin. And the kids responded almost immediately and showed a 6% increase in IQ. 6%. And the prison population showed a 38% decrease in criminal behavior.
May I just point out that his work has been shown to be true also in a major research in the UK and also in the Netherlands. And I have tried to speak to people associated with prisons. If there's anyone in this listening audience who wants to put me in touch with anyone, I can review this research, because with that much replication, showing at least a 30% decrease in every case with placebo controls, okay, 30% decrease in difficulties with, you know, violent infractions, et cetera. Every prison should be looking at that. And instead, what you see in the news, and I saw this from an American privatized prison, where the warden bragged about feeding his people on less than a dollar a day. Now, that's insane. And it's like you were saying, there's no free lunch, right? Because there is no cheap food. You pay for it with other care, you know, more wardens, more whatever.
So you end up paying $500 million a year to keep 18,000 people who can't keep themselves. And so that the cheap food always comes back and bites you right in the butt.
Right, right. By the way, there's also some research to suggest, and I wish there were more, research to show that people who are going through withdrawal trying to get off of various kinds of drugs do better if they're given broad-spectrum micronutrients. We need more research on that. Be happy to talk to anybody who is interested. May I mention my website?
Oh, please,
Michael,
do.
So
yes, please do. Go right ahead.
So my name, Bonnie Kaplan, is kind of common. So my website has to use my middle initial, which is J. So it's BonnieJKaplan.com.
Look for The Better Brain, which is the name of her new book that she co-authored with Julia Rutledge, another PhD. Wow. Thank you so much, Bonnie. Well, it's been a pleasure just talking with you. Do you think we can eat our way out of dystopia?
I'm waiting for you to put me in charge of the homeless. 500 million.
She's ready to go.
And then we can do it. I'm ready to go.
There you go, folks. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. And thank you all for tuning in. And thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.